يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Hello and welcome to another Middle East Analysis. As usual, I'm joined by Dr. Harry Hagopian. I could ream off all his titles, but we'll go for international lawyer, consultant to the bishops on the Middle East, and all-round good bloke, obviously. How are you, Harry?
I'm fine, and the most important one is the all-round good bloke, James. It's been 5 weeks, so it's a pleasure to be sitting in studio with you.
No, you're right. It's been a long time, and of course,
it has. And 5 weeks is an eternity in what's happening with the Middle East and North Africa these days.
Isn't it just? So that's what you're here for, Harry. So we're going to get the lowdown. We're going to talk a little bit about the situation in Syria with refugees streaming into Turkey. We are going to take in Yemen and the situation there with President Ali Abdullah Saleh actually in Riyadh recovering in Saudi Arabia. And we are going to talk Bahrain and the lifting of emergency laws and a particular court case that you're going to fill us in on, Harry, a bit later on. We're going to touch on Saudi, Lebanon, and of course, catch up on where we're at with the situation in Libya.
Okey-doke.
So Harry, let's start with
Syria. Have you got all day, James?
I was thinking 20 minutes, if that's doable.
You're always more optimistic than I am, so let's start.
Let's give it a whirl. So Harry, Syria and the situation there deteriorating, surely?
The situation in Syria is deteriorating. I mean, it's becoming worse and worse. The military crackdown in the northwestern town of Jisr al-Shuhur is really worrying. And what is happening now is really bordering on an open confrontation between the peoples and the military establishment and the regime in Syria. And it worries me because Syria is such a strategic country for the whole Middle East that we never know what could happen. We don't know what will happen if the regime manages to survive this challenge, and we don't know what might happen if the regime actually falls. But at the moment, as things are going, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners have seen horrifying pictures on our television screens and YouTubes about kids who are being maimed and brutalized once they're arrested, about the number of dead people. We're now talking well over 1,000 people who are already dead. The refugees who are streaming into Turkey at the moment. All this doesn't augur well, neither for Syria nor for the whole region, James.
I still find this confusing because when we've seen President Bashar al-Assad in the past, we see a man who seems comfortable, certainly with travelling and speaking to the statesmen of the West. But yet we hear things coming out of the regime, the authorities there, that don't seem to ring true. We hear about soldiers being dug up that have been killed and so forth in brutal fashions. And they seem to feel that they're the ones put upon here. What's the truth?
Well, it's very difficult to find out the exact truth, and I can't sit here in all honesty and tell you that I know exactly what's happening in Syria, and that's a line that every journalist and every wire agency is taking, because the very fact remains that the Syrian authorities prevent any foreign journalists from coming into the country. So if they are so certain that their story is the accurate one and that they're being put upon by the people and that there are indeed armed terrorists or people, groups running around attacking soldiers, attacking the people, then having foreign journalists there would help clarify the situation. The fact that we're living in a darkness and the only way that we can actually find out what's happening is either through Twitter, through Facebook, through YouTube, through mobile cameras, and the fact that there is now a new industry which is almost like a shadow internet agencies that are coming up, which are managing to buy bypass the internet interruptions and disconnections that regimes in that part of the world do in order to prevent people from sending information outside the country. But what is happening, no matter how true or untrue it is, and I do always say that we have to be a bit cautious when we talk about situation we don't know much about. I don't know if you've heard, there was that famous lesbian Syrian blogger hoax.
Oh, the hoax blogger.
The hoax blogger who was sending information about all the atrocities taking place in Syria, and suddenly we found out that there is no such Syrian lesbian blogger somewhere in Syria, but that this blogger is actually a middle-aged Western man in Edinburgh who is sending the information. So we have to be careful and we have to take some of it with some caution. However, the amount of information coming out about the crackdown, the Amnesty International report which just came out talking about children being attacked, the pictures we had of people like young kids like Hamza Khatib and others who actually were brutalized, I mean, that is not normal. So something is definitely happening. The people are worried, the people are frightened, and if we do not manage to prevail upon the authorities in Syria that they have to undertake reforms rather than continue subjugating their people, then this could turn even nastier than what we see today.
But then we look at the news stories and so forth. I might be ignorant, but I seem to be seeing or reading about the president's brother or other people more than him himself. And then it's telling that you hear from Prime Minister Erdogan from Turkey, who obviously has had a landslide victory just yesterday on Sunday, a bit freer to speak. He's been pretty outspoken in what he thinks. But yet the president still has this, for some reason, a huge amount of goodwill. So quite fortunate in that the international community still wants to talk.
The international community wants to talk with him, and the European Union and the United States want to talk to him for two reasons, James, I believe. The first is that they cannot afford, we cannot afford in the West to do another Libya. There's no way we can go into another military NATO-style intervention in Syria. We don't have the resources, we don't have the military wherewithal to do that.
But hang on, aren't the atrocities as bad?
The atrocities in some cases are worse, but that's where the double standards come up. That's why every time you speak with people from the region who are fighting for their citizenship rights, for democracy, for freedom, for their basically their dignity. That's what we're talking about. The bottom line is dignity here. They say, well, you went around bombing Libya because of what Colonel Gaddafi is or is not doing. Well, we know that the Syrian regime is doing more. Why don't you intervene there? Why don't you do something there? But when you talk about that, then of course you bring into the whole picture what's happening in Yemen, what's happening in Bahrain, what's happening in other countries. So are we in the West the policemen of the world or the region? And if we are, can we afford it? First, I don't think we are the policemen of the world. We're not going to repeat a colonial history here. Secondly, we can't afford it. Thirdly, I must add also, James, that the regime and President Bashar al-Assad himself has a lot still of credit and popularity in the country. The problem that's happening now is that the people he is surrounded by, or he himself has changed his mind in such a way that all his reformist tendencies are either not coming out or not wanting to come out.
So, finally, Harry, I've asked this before when it comes to Syria, but we've talked about the situation, the plight of those Iraqi Christians, particularly in the north, that have found safe haven in Syria. Yeah. So I must ask you again, in June 2011, is Syria a safe haven for Christians?
Well, that's the big question at the moment, and there are lots of people who are talking about it. I don't know if your listeners are aware, but the so-called opposition in Syria, which is anything but an opposition because there is no coherence, and this is part of the reason that we in the West do not exactly know whom to speak with as an alternative power structure to the one that exists at the moment. But they had two meetings in Antalya in Turkey and then again in Brussels in order to try and form the structures of what could become a coherent, cohesive opposition. That hasn't yet happened, and that is a problem. And secondly, of course, the big question is, I remember personally sitting here in front of you and saying that the two countries where I felt that the Christian communities had some safety were Jordan and Syria. Well, in Syria at the moment, there are so many stories about their collusion with the regime, that they want the regime to stay because they feel protected, or that they are with the rebels and the people who are demonstrating in the streets against the regime. I believe that at the moment, the Christian community, just as pretty much anybody else, including all other small communities, such as the Alawites, to which the president himself belongs, which is a kind of Shi'i Muslim confession, as well as the Kurds and others, are in a difficult position. And Turkey is also in a difficult position because two allies of Syria, until those demonstrations started, were Qatar and Turkey. Now Qatar and Turkey have pretty much turned against what is happening in Syria and what the regime is allowing to happen with its military crackdown. And I think that the whole idea, the Turkish idea that the foreign minister Davutoglu has of a zero problem policy is basically unraveling. So unless we manage to do something to prevail upon the Syrian regime, short of military intervention, that they should stop killing their people and they should basically go into some sort of national dialogue in order to not necessarily get rid of the regime, but to stop all those atrocities, we're going to be sitting and talking about Syria again, I'm afraid, in a couple of weeks' time.
I think we probably are. But let's move on to Yemen now. And I would say a different situation, certainly an eye-opening situation, with the president, since the time we last spoke, having suffered a rocket attack on his compound. And he now allegedly, you know better than I, is in Riyadh being treated in Saudi Arabia for those injuries.
Yep.
Is there a power vacuum, Harry?
Well, that's the big question. I mean, what has happened in Yemen is very interesting. You said the missile attack, because there are now rumors all over the place whether it was a missile attack or whether it was a bomb that exploded in the mosque itself. But that be as it may, it is quite clear that he was injured, and he was injured more seriously than the PR and the press releases and the media said at the time. And he is in Riyadh. Now, there has been a Gulf Cooperation Council initiative to get President Ali Abdullah Saleh out of the country so that within 30 days he seats power and then there are new elections and there is a new president. And people thought, okay, this injury and his flight out of the country because of medical treatment might be the appropriate way of getting rid of the president and trying to reform the situation. Why? Because at the end, before he was injured, Yemen, and I think I intimated to this in our last conversation, was on the very brink of a civil war. Mm. And the reason it was on the brink of a civil war is that the president himself was turning it into one as a way of showing how important it was for him to stay in the country, to keep the country
stability
together.
Yeah.
And the standoff was between the Al-Hashid tribe, and the Al-Hashid tribe is one of the biggest tribes in Yemen, and Sheikh Sadiq Ahmar is the chief of the tribe, and that tribe was in confrontation with the president's sons, nephews, and the president's tribe. And it was becoming increasingly worrying because in Zanzibar and other parts of Yemen also, there were rumors that Al-Qaeda of that part of the world was also beginning to infiltrate in force into the country, which would make us in the West even more anxious and careful about its consequences. So he's not there now. The question is, could we manage to do something that would reconstitute the political situation in such a way that there is a fairer representation of all Yemenis in the country, those with the president and those against him? And the fear is still, and that's a fear that the West shares, is that if he's not there, who's going to fill that black hole? And part of the problem across the whole Middle East, North Africa region, James, as you well know, is that when you have one-party systems, autocracies, dictatorships, they manage to decimate all institutions so that they become the one and only reference. Get rid of them. There is no alternative. We here in the West, if Labour Party is not in power, you've got the Tories, you've got the Lib Dems. The West is different. In a democracy, it's different. There, it's either me or the deluge. And at the moment, it's between him and the deluge. And therefore, there is so much energy to try and do something about that. And I'm keeping my fingers crossed.
Well, then you talk about power brokering, and I think that's going on throughout the region, it has to be said.
It is.
But you have the vice president, and you need to correct my pronunciation if I'm wrong, but Abd Rabu Mansour Hadi.
Yes, he is.
Now, I hear today, and things are moving so fast, we need a time marker. It's Monday, June the 13th.
Indeed.
I heard that he was in discussions with various groups to sort of bring about a transition. Is that the case?
Well, I mean, the president and the vice president now, who's taken over constitutionally while the president is outside the country being treated. I mean, there have been a whole raft of negotiations on and off all the time to try and find some sort of a consensus, a national dialogue. Which one of those will work? That's the big question mark. Just to give you an example, the Gulf Cooperation Council, which includes includes heavyweights such as Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, went twice to Yemen in order to sign that piece of paper, which would trigger or kickstart this process of the handover of power. And both times, the president refused to sign it at the very last minute. So the fact that they are trying again does not necessarily mean that they will succeed. And this brings me to the principal point that it is not an elegant situation as we would understand it in the West today, whereas, okay, you get the two parties together, you sit around the table, you take this piece of paper out, and you have a transitional arrangement. The situation there is so tribal, so clannish, so religious, so ethnic, so confessional, so politically distorted, that you have a Pandora's box, and the minute you open that Pandora's box, God help us what comes out, how would it affect the region, but also the ripples or after effects of the region would of course be felt by us here in the West, i.e. in Europe, and also further afield.
Let me ask you one final question on Yemen. Is it the case that, I mean, again, we've got a president here who's been in power a long, long time, who no doubt has looked across at Mubarak in Egypt, has looked at the Arab Spring and what's going on in the region. And is it not better for him to sort of promise and say there'll be a transition, make all these promises? Has he not learnt, perhaps, that it's better to promise and not deliver and hang on for a bit longer?
James, this is a PhD question that is being asked to a BA student, because what puzzles me is that you're absolutely spot on. If those leaders in Yemen, but also in Syria and in other parts of the Middle East and North Africa, if they look at what happened in Tunisia and Egypt, if they look at the demonstrations in their own countries, they would then say that there is at least a 50% likelihood that they will not stay in power if they do not undertake reforms and early enough to diffuse the tension, because once the tension gets to a certain height or crescendo, then it's very difficult to bring it down and say to people, okay, now I will give you this. And they will say, too late, we want more than this. So my question is, don't people like the president of Yemen, like the president of Syria, like the king of Bahrain, like others, Libya, don't they realize that at the end, they might actually meet the same fate as their Tunisian and Egyptian equals? Or is it a question indeed of it's either my way or the highway? And in which case, either they do everything they can and use all the tricks and ploys they have to stay in power, even if that means killing their people, or alternatively being led out, basically either dead or arrested or having lost all control of the army. Because the important thing in autocracies is that we don't talk in terms of democratic principles. We talk in terms, if tomorrow the army turns against the regime, any of those regimes, which are cardboard regimes, would drop within 24 hours. But the army itself is not doing that. And therefore, the confrontation, the violent confrontations that are taking place in Yemen, in Syria, and in other parts of the region, for which the ordinary Joe Bloggers of the Arab and Middle Eastern and North African worlds are paying the price for, with blood.
I think you've thrown a few things back at us and our listeners there, so definitely points for consideration and prayer. And as you said before, again, I'm sure we'll be looking at this again in a couple of weeks.
We will. I think this is for the long haul. This is not something I thought even that, okay, with Tunisia and Egypt the way they were, well, this might actually happen quite quickly, and after a century of slumber, the Arab world would wake up and we would have some sort of democratic ideals and some sort of a system which we could work with. But clearly, that's not what's happening, and we're in for the long haul.
Let's talk Bahrain now. Uh-huh. I'd like you to explain to me what the emergency laws exactly were, being a legal man yourself. But I hear they've been lifted. Yeah. And I know we're also going to talk about a very particular court case that is going on today, again, June the 13th, that might just reveal one or two things. But tell us a little bit about the lifting of those laws.
Well, basically, emergency laws, or what are accurately known in Bahrain as martial laws, are basically laws that you impose, which allow you to do anything in a moment of emergency. In other words, arrest people, detain people, stop things, attack demonstrators, use military force, what have you. So Bahrain is a very tiny statelet. It's a little island which was very, very successful. Financially, it was one of the financial hubs of that part of the world. It also had a high education level. women's rights, surprisingly enough, perhaps for some listeners, were much, much better evolved in Bahrain than in many other places. And yet, look at where we are. It's also a little statelet which unfortunately has a majority of Shi'i population, and the ruling dynasty, the Khalifa dynasty, are Sunni. I said unfortunately in the sense that it's almost these days like the Sunni and Shi'i sects of Islam have a problem coexisting, and therefore what is happening is that the monarchy, the dynasty that is in power, is trying to do everything to make sure that it keeps the levers of power in its own hand. So for a country that could pride itself not only financially but with women's rights and with gender equality, relatively speaking, I'm talking in cultural terms, I'm not talking about British or Eurocentric terms. Mm-hmm. What's happening now is that there is a crackdown on women. I mean, imagine there is a woman there whose story struck me so much, and I think it will strike a chord with a lot of our listeners. Ayatel Gomezi is a young university woman who stood up in a demonstration in Bahrain and who read a poem asking the king, the ruler of Bahrain, to provide freedom, liberty, citizenship rights and dignity to his citizens, all his citizens. The crackdown on her and others like her was incredible. She was detained, she was arrested, she was threatened. So it just shows you what is happening there. I'll give you another example. I think you mentioned in your intro about a case. Well, the case in itself is quite incredible in the sense that when there were much more violent confrontations a few weeks ago, there were so many wounded people who went to hospital, and the doctors, Bahraini doctors, were treating those demonstrators who were fired at, shot at, and who ended up in hospital, and they were being treated for their wounds. Now, the state is prosecuting some of those doctors for having actually treated those demonstrators whom the regime considers as being anti-regime and therefore an enemy of the state. Can you imagine a doctor whose calling is to save lives? You basically take him to court on a misdemeanor or a crime for treason, for whatever, because you treated the people. I mean, what are doctors supposed to do? Not treat them?
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, you know, you mentioned the economy, and you mentioned that the value of money, and you know, I think sporting events, you think the Bahrain Grand Prix.
The Grand Prix, which is now cancelled.
Indeed, but there will sort of, if you like, feel it in the pocket, as it were, won't they? So, you know, this sort of comparative equality that you're talking about, the fact that that's gone out of the window a bit, I mean, that there will be repercussions, certainly when very, very, very cash-rich sporting events such as Formula One turn their back.
Of course there will be repercussions, and when Bernie Ecclestone said that it's not going to happen, that was a very big shock to Bahrain, who wanted to show that there is a sense of normality, and there's so much money to be made from the ads, etc., of any such sporting activity. But the same is true across the region. What the EU, for instance, in Syria is doing these days, and in other countries, is it's trying to close the financial taps, and in order to increase the pressure, that's what it's doing in Iran, for instance, so that to use the pressure points that are available to the West, short of direct intervention, which is something that we either cannot afford to do or do not want to do because we've got our own geostrategic and vested interests. And at the end of the day, states are not humanitarian organizations or churches. They are institutions, entities with interest. Or alternatively, anything that we are trying to do, such as with Syria, Britain and France and others are doing, we're being checkmated by Russia, by China and by the others who threaten to use their veto power in the United Nations. So it's a very, very tricky situation. And I think the message that comes out of all this, James, is something that you and I, over the past few months of discussing the MENA uprisings, have learned, is that it's a messy situation. And my grandmother used to tell me always, Harry, don't open boxes when you don't know what's inside them. And in a sense, I agree with her. She has the wisdom, my grandmother, that I hope I will one day acquire. But at the same time, I also disagree with her, because if we don't open that box and we don't get rid of all what's inside, we will never make a step forward.
Harry, do you not know that you're just simply not allowed to disagree with your grandmother?
Well, forgive me, James. I love my grandmother a lot, but I'm from a different generation, as she would readily remind me.
Well, I'm glad she's made an appearance on Middle East Analysis. I'd like to move on to Saudi.
Uh-huh.
Again, you know, a place that we have our preconceived ideas of. But first of all, I'd like you to tell me about the... We talked women's rights, didn't we? Tell me about the Intifada there. But first of all, tell me exactly what one of those is.
Well, an Intifada is basically from the Arabic verb yantafid, which means to shake off. And basically, what do you shake off? You shake off dust, you shake off oppression, you shake off subjugation. So an Intifada is an uprising in the sense of getting rid of the shackles and the oppression that is being visited upon you.
We're talking women's right to drive here, aren't we?
We are talking about women's right to drive, and it is amusing to us here in the West, and certainly to your listeners, that the actual mere fact of a woman driving her own car in Saudi Arabia is absolutely frowned upon. In fact, not only frowned upon, it's illegal, and you just simply cannot do it. So now Saudi Arabia, which is the largest oil-rich country and which has a huge weight in the region and which has not become involved with those uprisings, at least not yet. Amusingly enough, this whole campaign, this whole protest campaign by Saudi women to be allowed to drive is being dubbed or described as an intifada. And actually, on the 17th of June, in 4 days' time, there is a protest in Saudi by all those veiled women who want to insist upon their right to drive their own cars rather than only be able to go from their houses to point A or B in a cab, and there are about 700,000 of those in the kingdom, or alternatively a relative has to be with you so that you are not allowed as a woman to be on your own in somewhere in the kingdom.
Do you foresee us having a lesbian blogger here that might actually be a middle-aged Scotsman?
Well, anything is possible, to be honest with you, James. But, I mean, for me, it's very interesting. The Saudi authorities talk about piety, and they talk about the fact that the Holy Quran doesn't allow women to drive, and that in a sense basically women should follow men in their attitudes and their mores. I actually disagree with that, and I disagree with that on two levels, James. On the one level, even if I take it theologically from the Holy Quran's perspective, I look at Aisha. Aisha was the Prophet Muhammad's favorite wife, and she actually, I remember the story of once commanding an army, and this is going back to 14 centuries, commanding an army when Islam just began and the Prophet was alive, and she rode a camel in order to command the army and attack the enemy. So if Aisha, the Prophet Muhammad's wife, is allowed to ride a camel and command an army, surely the women of today in Saudi Arabia would be allowed not to ride camels necessarily, but to drive cars. So for me, basically, this whole Intifada, this whole idea of can they or can't they be allowed to drive, and this becoming an issue, which to me is a diversionary tactic, by the way, from the real issues bedeviling Saudi Arabia as a kingdom, is not one of piety, it's simply one of subordination. And I believe, no matter what my faith is, I believe that we are all born as equals in the image and likeness of God, and I do not accept that a woman has to be subordinate to man just because she's a woman.
Now, Harry, we're fast running out of time.
And we are.
We could talk about Misrata, which I believe is still surrounded on three of the four sides.
It is, except the northern side, which it is not. Basically, to put it in one sentence, James, and we'll do Libya perhaps next time, the rebels are still fighting. Colonel Gaddafi is still fighting back. Yesterday, there were pictures of him playing chess in his palace with a Russian eccentric. So there is a standstill which lends credence to what I've been saying, and people much more experienced than I have been saying over many weeks, that in fact the Catholic Archbishop of Tripoli has said the same thing as well, that military attacks in themselves will not resolve the Libyan crisis. We also have to know how to negotiate with the colonel and to make him understand that it is time for him to pack his bags and leave. But if we don't give him that option through negotiation and we keep just pounding Libya in the hope that he will flee, then he's going to stay there and the situation is going to be getting worse and worse for God knows how long.
Well, why don't we make a point of revisiting this again in a fortnight or so?
Let's do that.
Would you like to finish, Harry, by talking to us a little bit about the 6th anniversary of the murder of Samir Kassir?
Yes, I would like that. Thank you, James, for giving me the opportunity to do that. Today is the 6th anniversary of the assassination of Samir Kassir. Samir Kassir was a philosopher, a historian, an academic in Lebanon, and a wonderful person who, had he been living today, he would have said that most of the predictions that he had made years ago before he was assassinated, actually there was a bomb under his car that blew off. He basically fought for freedom, for democratic values, for equality, and for the ideals that the whole Middle East, North Africa region is fighting for today. So in a sense, this man who was assassinated 6 years ago is one, in my opinion, one of the emblems of what is happening today. You know, there are many, many emblems that to me mark those stations across the Middle East, North Africa. If you remember in 2001, when there was the fight between the Israelis and the Palestinians, we saw that picture of Mohammed Doura, who was hugging his little kid in a corner of his street, trying to protect the kid from the live bullets coming his way. Then if you remember in 2009, there was Nada Agha Sultan, that beautiful Iranian woman who was gunned down, and the picture went viral across the internet. Then we had Mohammed Abu Azizi in Tunisia in 2010. Well, Samir Kassir to me represents that icon of the ideals that I wish would become part and parcel of Lebanon. To do that, we have to be open to national dialogue. We have to be open to reconciliation. And that is, incidentally, James, something that the new Maronite Patriarch of Lebanon, His Beatitude Al-Rai, is doing a lot by holding many Christian as well as Christian Muslim meetings at Bkirke, the patriarchal seat, in order to try and diffuse the tensions and get the Lebanese to talk to each other. If that kind of exercise were to become more productive and spread across the region, then perhaps we would be able to spare ourselves all the pain that men and women are suffering throughout the region.
Well put, Harry. Well, maybe we should try and speak to His Beatitude at some point to contribute to our program without making any grand promises.
Well, His Beatitude, hopefully at some stage we might even be able to invite him to visit the United Kingdom as a guest of the Conference of Catholic Bishops. So in a sense, James, why? Everything is possible. And again, I come back to the same thing. It's a messy situation across the whole region. Your listeners would know that 5 days ago, Israelis and Palestinians remembered the Six-Day War, which resulted in this occupation and in this unending misery, not only for one people, for two peoples, because the winner and the loser are both losing, in my opinion, unless they've resolved this conflict. All this is messy. All this is going to take time, but it needs goodwill, it needs good faith. And for me, faith is made incarnate in prayer as well.
Absolutely. Well, I tell you something, it's going to take more than the half an hour we've got on air today.
Absolutely.
So, Dr. Harry Hagopian, as always, thank you ever so much for your insight, and do join us again in a few weeks when we can catch up.
My pleasure, James. Thank you.
Thanks, Harry.